Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of March 14th, 2014. This week, we're wondering, does the word bossy set women back in the workplace and the world? Plus, how to keep your data safe when everything is moving online? It was a big topic at South by Southwest. We'll get a report. And believe it or not, it's actually cheaper to buy a house than rent. So why the hesitation, especially among millennials? But we're going to start with another story where young people are important. The Affordable Care Act. The March 31st enrollment deadline is about 2 weeks away, and this is the big one. Get covered or start paying a penalty. To talk about this, we're joined by our healthcare correspondent, Dan Gorenstein. He's at WHYY in Philadelphia. Welcome back, Dan.
Hey, Lizzie.
The Affordable Care Act deadlines have moved around a fair amount. March 31st, the deadline to enroll in coverage, is that a hard, real deadline?
Hard like granite. Hard like the Washington Monument. Secretary of Health and Human Services Kathleen Sebelius said this is not moving at all. March 31st is a hard deadline. That's what she told congressional lawmakers earlier this week.
If someone enrolls, picks one of those plans from the exchange by the end of March, when are they covered by one of their plans?
It can be confusing. But look, here's the basic formula, Lizzie. If you enroll before the 15th of March, your coverage will start April 1st. That's kind of funny. If you enroll on the 16th or later, your coverage begins May 1st.
Okay. The administration has been making a big push to try to get people enrolled, including having the president go on the fake cable access show with comedian Zach Galifianakis called Between Two Ferns. Let's listen to a little bit of that.
Okay, let's get this out of the way. What did you come here to plug?
Well, first of all, I think it's fair to say that I wouldn't be with you here today if I didn't have something to plug. Have you heard of the Affordable Care Act?
Oh, yeah, I heard about that. That's the thing that doesn't work. Why would you get the guy that created the Zune to make your website?
Healthcare.gov works great now. And millions of Americans have already gotten health insurance plans. And what we want is for people to know that you can get affordable health care. And most young Americans right now, they're not covered. And the truth is that they can get coverage all for what it costs you to pay your cell phone bill.
Is this what they mean by drones?
A much-loved show on Funny or Die.
Yeah.
What we heard in there, Dan, was a really big plug for young people. What's going on behind that?
Well, first of all, like, that thing was hilarious. It's so hilarious that 11 million people, or at least it was viewed 11 million times on the web on Tuesday.
Which the White House loves to point out.
Yes, and 32,000 people went from that interview directly to healthcare.gov. Young people are really important. The simple math is this. The more people you have in these risk pools that are young and healthy, the less expensive it is for insurers, and so the premium prices in 2015, next year, will go down. That's sort of the simple thinking. But I think what people kind of forget is that a healthy 52-year-old is better than a sick 28-year-old. And the other thing that people've got to realize and sort of like get their hands on is that even if you signed every healthy American up into one of these plans, premiums are going to go up next year. I mean, that's not a surprise. That's not a shock. Talk to somebody who's in the industry who was saying to me, expect 6 to 7% premium increases at a minimum, and it might be more depending on the state that you live in.
The administration set a goal for itself of having 6 million people enrolled in the Affordable Care Act. How hard a goal is that for them to hit?
So earlier this week, the administration came out and said as of March 1st, they were at 4.2 million people. The AP did something pretty fun this week. They did the math on this, and they said to hit that 6 million person enrollment figure, somebody's got to sign up every 1.4 seconds in the rest of March. That's 60,000 people a day. And to give you some kind of comparison, Lizzie, the daily averages in January and February were between 33 and 34,000.
I want to pivot. There's another part of the Affordable Care Act, which was expanding Medicaid to up to 140% of the poverty line. But some states are not actually part of that Medicaid expansion. So what do you do if you live in a state where that's not happening? What are the options available?
If you live in one of these states, Lizzie, that's not expanding Medicaid, Texas, Nebraska, Maine, they're about half of the states that aren't expanding right now, and you earn above the poverty level, which is about $12,000 for an individual, you can qualify for a subsidy that's going to help you buy a plan. So you can't enroll in Medicaid, which would effectively be free apart from some copays, some modest copays, but you can get a real generous subsidy from the government to help you pay for a plan. Now, whether you can afford that or not is the open question, but you are at least eligible. I was talking with Judy Solomon at the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities about this, and she said the people who get hurt most are the adults who earn below that poverty level. Many times these are people who are disabled or have a real difficult time holding down a job. Here's what she said to me.
You know, it's very sad to, you know, tell people that despite what they hear in the press and all the outreach, that they're left out because they don't earn enough.
At the end of the day, there are going to be people who live in states that are not expanding Medicaid, who have no ability to access insurance this year.
Dan Gorenstein, our healthcare reporter, speaking to me from Philadelphia. Thank you so much, Dan.
Thanks, Lizzie.
We've got more info about the Affordable Care Act, including some user reviews from listeners like you. That's at marketplacemoney.org. When you go home at night, what are you going home to? Are we talking single-family home, picket fence kind of thing, a condo in a complex, or maybe an apartment in a big building? An article in the Wall Street Journal this week caught our eye. It said the share of new homes being built as rental apartments is at its highest level in more than 40 years. That's a huge shift. To talk about where we live and why, we're joined by Nicholas Ritsinas. He's Director Emeritus at the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard University. It's nice to talk to you again.
Hey, nice to talk to you.
Let's start with the idea that new home building is shifting to apartments instead of single-family homes. What does that tell us about where Americans want to live, or maybe where Americans can afford to live?
Well, it tells us a lot about the market. Lest we forget, we still build more single-family homes than multifamily homes. But you are right to note that we are seeing a greater increase in the number of multifamily homes. Part of that relates that we overbuilt single-family homes. In the crisis of 2008 and beyond, as we know, we built too many homes, and many of them have now been lost to foreclosure and stand as empty shells. On the other hand, we stopped building multifamily homes during that period. So part of this is a catch-up responding to what has been a changing marketplace.
Who's moving into those apartments? Are we talking about people who are moving out of their parents' homes or people who were hurt by the recession? Who's the market?
Again, a combination of all of those. Clearly, we are starting to see growth in the number of households. For a period of time, we did not when young adults were staying with their parents. But now they're starting to move up. And as they look at what the options are, for some, renting is a very good option for lots of good reasons. On the other hand, for some who may have wanted to buy a home, they find that access to credit is more difficult than it once was.
Let's talk about interest rates. Where they are today, how do you make that calculation, that rent versus buy calculation? We get a lot of calls from people who are nervous that the Federal Reserve's tapering is going to impact their ability to get a good interest rate.
Well, it will. I think most economists would agree that interest rates are more likely to rise than to stay steady or certainly not fall over time. Therefore, this is an advantageous time in terms of the cost of money and the cost of borrowing money. On the other hand, looking at the owning versus renting, there are a number of factors involved. An interest rate is one of them, but not the only one. There's an expectation of what future appreciation may be or what house price decline might be. There's an expectation of what your needs are in terms of where you live and the kinds of family you have and the kinds of room you need. So there are lots of factors going into it, but clearly rising interest rates, to the extent they do rise, are going to make that choice even more difficult.
The firm Trulia ran the numbers and found that in 100 big metro areas, buying a home is 38% cheaper than renting. What does that tell you about buying versus renting? Or is that just too diffuse a number? Does it depend on where you live?
Well, of course, it always depends on where you live and what market you're in and what community you're in and what's going on in that community overall. It tells me that in some cases, we overcorrected in terms of price declines. It tells me that low interest rates do make buying a home more affordable. So it tells me a lot about that. I think what is as interesting, though, is notwithstanding record low interest rates, notwithstanding the recent experience of home price declines, I'm amazed that still so many people are interested in buying a home.
Why do you think that is? What's the psychology behind that?
Hard to say. I think part of it is a long-term belief that people want to control their own property. They want to control their own destiny. Part of it is purely financial. It's a hedge. In financial terms, people are worried that rents may someday rise, and indeed we are seeing in many markets rents rising. Part of that has to do with the stock available. There are more single-family homes that are amenable to larger families than there are apartments overall. So there are a lot of factors going involved in this, but I think this interest in home ownership is one that is of long standing.
So you think the dream of the ownership society still kind of grips the American psyche?
You know, I think in large measure it does. A recent survey that we reported on said that 19 out of 20 people under the age of 45 expect one day to own a home. That doesn't mean they necessarily will. That may not even mean they want to, but they expect to over time. So I think this notion of home ownership and owning a home, while not uniquely American, is certainly embedded here in America.
A lot of millennials are skeptical about owning really anything, it seems. Is there anything wrong with renting indefinitely?
No, not at all. Indeed, one of the problems in the past is we demonize renting. It's as if only if you were dumb, only if you weren't smart, only if you weren't hardworking, only if you weren't entrepreneurial, otherwise you would own a home. I think now we realize for many people, renting is a better financial option overall. And certainly in the kind of market we are for young people, it gives people more mobility options than they would have before.
Nick Ritsinas at Harvard University, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Up next, Liz Weston joins us to tackle your money questions. And later, a Facebook exec is leading the charge to ban bossy. But one blogger says, hey, being bossy ain't so bad.
I think that the word bossy is a point of pride for many women. It's a powerful word. The description bossy links generations of go-getters who are comfortable in their skin and powerhouses in their profession.
That's on Marketplace Money from APM. It's that time again where we talk to you, the listeners, and here to help me answer your money questions is Liz Weston. She's the author of the book, The Ten Commandments of Money, and a friend of our show. Hi, Liz.
Hey, Lizzie.
So our first caller is Mary in Houston, Texas. Hi, Mary.
Hi there.
That's my mother's hometown, the land of the flying roaches.
That was really unfair. Have you looked at the economy here? It is booming.
It is booming. I have deep family ties to Houston. I do love it, actually. But I want to talk to you. Actually, your personality vibrates through everything you wrote us. You described yourself as a recovering financial nitwit, which was amazing. You said you had poor credit, not enough saved for retirement, but you've actually got a pretty decent income, $160,000, and kind of a windfall. Tell us what's going on.
Okay, so let me say that my salary, that's a very new thing in the last 2 years. What's going on now, so this will sound really dumb, but I'm finally in a job where they like recognize and like what I do. It's miraculous, but anyway, but the compensation is very complicated. And as a result, I did receive this windfall, and I don't even understand through vested and this and long-term incentive whether it's ever going to happen again. So I'm careful not to make any mistakes. Where I'm at right now is, so I have this money, and I have, I think, $22,000 left after I paid off most of my consumer debt, There's still $1,500 there. I paid off our medical expenses. I bought a new mattress because my husband said after 30 years, the dust mites are going to take over.
You might have a point there, Mary.
I know. But it's like I'm still sleeping on it. How much value does that add? I spent $2,000 on an electric fence to keep the dog in the yard because I figure that's better than paying for the therapy where the dog gets out and my daughter is devastated yet again. We have trees that need to be taken down. We have, you know, the yard kind of looks like someone doesn't live there anymore. And so I'm confused by all the choices I have to make. So, for example, when I'm standing in line at the grocery store and I see Money Magazine and it'll have a picture of a happy couple and it'll say, like, Bob and Biff only have $2.5 million in their retirement income. What should they do? Should they move to Mexico and live more cheaply? I can't even begin to identify. We have no equity in our house. We almost lost our house, and we were able to refinance through HARP, and now we're at 2% until next year, and then it'll gradually go up. I forgot to mention I have three kids in college, so just add that to the mix. I don't know whether to put it in retirement or to, oh, by the way, an emergency fund is like a whole new concept to us, so I need to do that. Currently, the way our house is structured, the mortgage, we will pay it off, I'm not kidding, like when we're 95.
So
I know that we need to do something to refinance in the next year. The bankruptcy will roll off in June. Our credit, I've worked very diligently to repair it. You know, with three kids in college, with finally a good job, I have about $195,000 in retirement at this point.
Oh.
And when I go to the little chart and it shows your financial picture and it says you will not get there from here.
Yes. Very discouraging.
And so it's like, and then they say, you know, click here to learn more. And then your two choices are, well, save more or retire later. And I like put in like the, you know, I'll retire at 75. Well, it still doesn't get me there. So I'm not quite sure what to do.
All right. Well, Liz Weston, take it away.
All right. Now, the $22,000 is left over from how much? What was the net that you got from this windfall?
It was $48,000.
Okay. All right. That's a good chunk of change. You don't know if that's going to be repeated. And you're smart to be worried about it dribbling away, because that's what usually happens. Small inheritances, windfalls like this, you feel rich for a while, you start buying things, and pretty soon the money's gone. Mary, how old are you?
54, and my husband's 64.
Okay. Is your husband on disability, on Social Security? Where's he at?
Social Security.
Okay. Did he start at 62?
Yes.
Let me back up. One of the things that I want to suggest right off the bat is stop looking for financial planners who are, charging based on how many assets you have in. I mean, there's a lot of guys like that. Look at Garrett Planning Network. They have financial planners who charge by the hour. And I tell you that, you know, the money that you spend there is going to pay off manyfold. You can get a relationship with somebody. You can pay them by the hour. You know the advice is going to be objective because they don't make money from commissions, kickbacks of any kind. So I really encourage, especially since you're so close to retirement age, the decisions you make now often can't be reversed. So you really want to have somebody to bounce these things off of. Does that make sense?
That makes perfect sense.
One of the most important things, Mary, is retirement. I know you've tried to use those calculators and come away going, oh, this is crazy. But it has to be your top priority. Even if you don't, you know, save as much as those calculators say you really should put it at the top of the heap, try to put as much money aside as you can. And then for the rest of the spending, I really like the 50-30-20 budget. Have you ever heard of that?
No, I haven't.
Okay. This is a budget that was originally created by Elizabeth Warren, who's now a senator, and her daughter, because Elizabeth Warren did a lot of work on bankruptcy. And what she found is people tend to overspend on the basics, on their house, on their car, you know, the basic bills. And so what she suggested is taking your after-tax income, dividing it in half, and spending no more than that on your basics, the stuff that you have to spend every month. Your shelter, your utilities, your food, minimum loan payments, child care if that's part of the mix. So that's 50%. Try to limit it to that. And what that does is it gives you the freedom to save 20% for your future, and also you can use some of that 20% to pay off debt. And then 30% is for living your life today. Because as you're finding, there are, you know, big expenses coming up day to day. You don't know how to fit those in. That's the way you fit them in. Now, I would say if you can kick that 20% up, you'll probably be better off in retirement. Technically speaking, where you're at right now, you probably should be saving 40% or more of your income if you wanted to retire, say, at 65. If you're cool with working until you're 70...
No. Cool with that. No. I mean, you know, there's only so much longer. Like, I can keep dyeing my hair. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, man. Oh, we understand.
Let's go back to just some basic things. So would you say, should I have paid off all my consumer debt altogether?
I would get rid of it. I mean, the first thing I would do is max out any retirement options that you've got. How much did you put? Have you been putting money into your 401k and maxing that out? Do you have a 401k? I guess that's the first question.
Yes, I have a 401k. And what I did was I did just do it to the maximum before tax contribution.
And is that the maximum for people under 50 or people over 50? Because you know we can put in more once we get over the 50-year mark.
Over 50.
Great.
And then I think there's a catch-up contribution, and that's the $5,400, and I haven't done that yet.
Okay. I literally take advantage, every possible advantage you can, of those pre-tax options for saving for retirement, because that's going to reduce your salary, your taxable salary, and it's going to help you get to your retirement goal. Not only is it you know, growing tax deferred, but you've been through bankruptcy once. You know what that's like. If that should ever happen again, those retirement funds are safe from your creditors.
All right, Mary, we're gonna send you out into the world with your plan and at least a couple of pieces of information to hold on to. And because I made a crack about the flying roaches, I will say that I am jealous that you are in the land of ninfas margaritas and that you can have one and that I can't. And I hope that we helped you out at least a little bit.
Yes, you sure did. I really appreciate it. It gives me a starting point.
Liz, can you stick around while we take a little break for more callers?
Absolutely.
This is Marketplace Money from APM. Our next caller is Liz in upstate New York. We're going to confuse everybody because we've got a Lizzie, a Liz, and another Liz. So Liz in upstate New York, I know you've got a question about renting from a family member, investing in your rental property. Welcome to the show. And why don't you tell us a little bit about the living situation that you and your husband are in?
We currently pay $400 a month to my in-laws for a home equity line of credit that we took from them to make the property livable back in 2007. And so it's about to be paid off. So we were just wondering, well, what's the next step? Should we invest more into the property to make it livable for the long term?
And my understanding is, right, that they own the home. It's on a lot that's adjacent to their property. Is that correct?
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about the improvements that you'd like to make and that what you're thinking about doing to this house.
We are thinking about investing about $50,000 in building a 3-car garage with a home office and Pilates studio.
Wow. And what's your income level, you and your husband combined?
About $180,000 a year.
Okay. One of the questions I have, and I'm wondering if Liz has the same one, have you guys talked about transferring ownership of the house from your in-laws to you and your husband?
Yes, we have, and everybody's on such great terms, and my in-laws are very open to turning it over to us. But we always end up just going back to, it seems like too much trouble, and you know, with good relations between all of us, we know that their intention is to turn it over to us at some point. We always go back to, well, why bother? I was just afraid of making such a big investment in the property that we don't own.
Yeah, I understand that. Liz Weston, what do you think?
Oh, I'd underline that. I'd put exclamation points after that. I mean, if these were just any landlords and you were renting, there's no way that you would put that kind of money into the property. And I know things are great now, and I'm so glad to hear that. It's so nice to hear people who like their in-laws. I love mine, so I know it's just great. But a lot of things can go wrong. You know, something could happen to your husband. There's the possibility that something could happen to one of your in-laws. They get remarried. The new spouse doesn't like the arrangement, and that puts the kibosh on it. I mean, I hate to bring up the specters of, you know, death and awful things happening, but the reality is you don't own this property. And there, even if your in-laws have promised it to you at some future point, you still don't own this property. So I would take the step of talking to them about getting the ownership transferred, make sure it's in your name before you spend another dime on it. Now, if you don't plan to live there a long time, that would be something different. But it sounds like you have put down some roots there.
Yes. Years ago, we weren't sure that we were going to stay living here, but we've made the decision that we do plan to stay here for probably at least 10 years.
Okay. So then buying makes a whole lot of sense. You'll be near them as they age, which is a big benefit to them. You know, you can look out for them, take care of them. So this is something, even though it seems like a hassle, I really would take care of it before you put another dime into the property because, as I said, it's not yours. It's not your asset. Things could go wrong. And the other thing is owning the property will help you get a loan if you want to, you know, get a home equity loan to do those improvements. If you don't own the property, if it's not the deed's not in your name, that's going to be tough to do.
Okay. Well, thank you. That's really helpful.
Liz, thank you so much for calling. Good luck.
Thank you.
Our last caller is Catherine in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and she's got a question about banking and credit scores. Hi, Catherine. Welcome to Marketplace Money.
Hello. Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Well, I have a question for you. You have written us this great email that really puts money in sort of hilarious relationship terms. You talked about breaking up with your bank. Tell us your story.
Well, I was I used U.S. Bank for a long time. I mean, even since I was like a teenager. And over the course of, you know, my adult life, it just got more and more annoying to work with a big corporate bank. You know, when you call, you can't get someone on the phone. They had all these crazy fees. And I have not only my personal accounts, but also business accounts. I'm a solo attorney, and I just got really sick of, you know, dealing with a corporate entity and not just a regular person. And so I looked around, and I was referred to a small local bank, like local just to Minnesota, called the Business Bank, and they were great. Everything was going on great, and then they got bought out by a regional bank from North Dakota, and things just started getting super inconvenient and kind of went downhill from there. I really don't like their online banking portal. Their ATMs are really weird. Like, you can deposit business checks into your business account through the ATM, but you can't deposit personal or stuff into your personal account. Their ATMs are inconvenient, and I do everything online and with my smartphone. I'm out and about all the time with my business, and so I, you know, have to be able to make deposits. And it's just gotten to this point where I want to break up with this bank. And so I've been starting to look around to more credit unions, more, you know, small local establishments, and there are some good ones in the Twin Cities. You know, I'm figuring out which one has ATMs that are kind of in my area. But what I'm concerned about is, you know, how is that going to look on a credit report if I switch banks, you know, a couple of times in a short period? And, you know, I'm not in the market for a loan right this second, but, you know, in a year and a half or so, I might want to get a new car or something. And I don't want this to be a red flag on my credit report just because I'm trying to get better service.
Well, Liz Weston, what do you think?
Well, I can reassure you that it won't. The credit scoring formulas pay attention to how you handle your credit accounts. So bank accounts don't even come into this unless, you know, it's a credit card you have with the bank. So bopping around and changing banks is a huge hassle. My hat's off to you for breaking up with the bank the first time. But it's not going to affect your credit long term. I will say, if you are going to be in the market for a car loan in the next 2 years, you'll probably wind up with a credit union anyway to get the best rates and terms. So that's definitely a place to look. But keep in mind that the smaller the outfit, the less the technology is going to be cutting edge. And when I used my credit union's online portal, in my head, I could hear that old modem sound screeching in the background.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, really? You know, are we this far behind the times? So don't necessarily rule out one of the big national banks, because you might find that you like the technology, and if you can, you know, establish some relationships with the office that's in your community, you might get that personal touch that you'd been missing with your other bank. I'm not saying that's the way to go. I'm just saying don't rule anything out at this point. If you're ready to leave your current bank, cast a wide net, because you might find that, well, you will find every bank has different policies. Every bank deals with their people better. And what they really care about isn't your, I mean, they'll look at your credit when they're establishing an account. What they really care about is how much money they can make from you. And,
yeah.
You know, it's, and you're an attorney, you know, you're going to be borrowing money from them. You're a really prime candidate. So they should really want your business.
Well, thank you very much, guys. That really answers my question. That was pretty simple.
Thank you so much for calling us, Catherine.
Thank you for answering my question. I'm a big fan of the show.
Thank you. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Liz, thank you for going through all these questions with me, and somehow we've managed not to confuse everybody with our names. Liz Weston is the author of The 10 Commandments of Money, Survive and Thrive in the New Economy, and a regular contributor here. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Coming up, an actor recalls some of his earliest lessons that he learned about money.
Watching my dad be a cheap ass. Taking me home from track practice one day, I said, oh, hey, can we drop my friend Chris off at his house on the way? And the joke became that he might slow down for Chris to get out of the car. Pulling into the driveway, back out of the driveway, was gas burning for no reason. Get out! Money's burning! You know what I mean?
That's just ahead on Marketplace Money from APM. This past week, technophiles from all over the globe have been gathering in Austin, Texas for South by Southwest, and one of them was our own Ben Johnson, the host of Marketplace Tech. He's back now. He had some breakfast tacos. He's here to talk about what he learned. Welcome back, Ben.
Hey, Lizzie.
So a lot of what was talked about there was privacy, a big theme at South by Southwest this year. Tell us a little bit about what we should be thinking about privacy.
Well, I'll tell you what people at the conference were thinking about. You know, the year before when I went to South By, it was all about disaster management apps. So this was following Sandy, of course, right? This year, it was all about privacy. And we have good reason for that. There's been a lot of stories about privacy surveillance this year, or, you know, in 2013, 2014. And two of the biggest speakers at the conference talked about this, Julian Assange and Edward Snowden. Interesting, both of them were not actually at the conference. They both called in from outside of the U.S. border. Snowden actually called in through seven online proxies.
Wow.
In order to, like, protect his location data while he actually spoke to a sold-out crowd there. He called on tech companies to lead the way on encryption to protect users' privacy first so that it would be harder for the government to access it. So there was a lot of buzz about privacy and data this year.
So I'm sometimes kind of a tech Luddite. Explain to me kind of how this translates to regular people in the real world.
Okay, so I'll give you, you know, and we all are in certain respects, right? But I'll give you an example of my own behavior while I was at the conference.
Yeah.
Wi-Fi was everywhere. Austin, Texas was awash in Wi-Fi. And one thing you always want to think about when you're using public Wi-Fi is what you're doing on public Wi-Fi. I was very careful about my banking. I did not visit my bank's website once while I was in Austin. I did a couple different things. I went into brick-and-mortar branches if I wanted to take money out. I also used my bank's app. which in many ways can be more secure because the bank has actually, or the financial institution has actually put a lot of effort into making sure that the app is secure. Even when you're on a Wi-Fi network that's protected by a password, say you're at a hotel and you get the password at the hotel, something like that, it's still not fully secure necessarily. And so it's a good idea to do a little bit of old school, a little bit of new school. You go into the brick and mortar, you like say hello to the teller, and maybe they're extra nice to you the next time you come back, or you use an app that you trust.
What about other kinds of data protection tips for people?
Well, we talked to a lot of people just out and around the conference about what they were thinking about when it came to divulging personal data and not divulging personal data. And a lot of people we talked to sort of drew this line at location data, which I thought was kind of interesting. We talked to volunteers who were working at the conference. We talked to some people from startups who were at the conference just to hang out. And they were thinking a lot about their social networks, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Now, these are all apps that want to access your location as part of the app, and often you don't have a choice about that. What you do have a choice about is whether you make your location public when you post on these social networks. And a lot of the people we talked to did not want to do that and had opted out of that. So, you know, it's always good to be careful about, or at least think about as you're using an app, whether or not it is posting your location data publicly.
What's the most interesting thing you saw at South by Southwest that blew your mind about privacy?
Okay, so I went to this presentation about embeddables. Another big topic at South by was wearables, and we all know what wearables are. These things you know, Fitbit, you put it on your wrist.
Okay.
Embeddables are things like this that you actually, sometime in the near future, might put inside your body. So you might have sensors inside your body, tiny computing devices that tell you everything from what your food is and what your diet is to other stuff. Now, there's a scary thing about that. The government. Eventually, what might happen is if you eat too many cheeseburgers in a given week and you've got a sensor inside your body, the government might say, hey, guess what? Your health insurance just went up.
This sounds like the Bionic Man. Thank you, Ben Johnson, for that peek into a potential dystopian future, but also your report on South by Southwest. Thanks for joining us.
No problem, Lizzie. Thanks.
You can see all of the tech team's great work from South by Southwest on our website. Go to marketplace.org to check it out. Every week on the show, we ask someone to reflect on how their financial habits were shaped by members of their family. Today, an actor who's played some memorable movie roles takes us on a tour of his childhood.
I'm Doug Jones. I'm an actor. I'm known for wearing lots of prosthetic rubber makeups in fantasy, sci-fi, horror, comic book movies. I'm 6'3 and a half. I weigh 140 pounds. I'm shaped weird, which makes me a ideal palette to build things on. It was in the Fantastic Four sequel as the Silver Surfer, Pan's Labyrinth as both the Fawn and the Pale Man, and the list goes on and on and on. I was born in 1960. I grew up in Indianapolis, Indiana. So I'm a good Midwestern boy. My household was very conservative, not only politically, but also their relationship with money. They instilled in me the value of spending less than you make. If you live beneath your means, you will always have means. It wasn't so much conversations where here's life lessons, Dougie. It was more about leading by example and watching my dad be a cheap ass. Taking me home from track practice one day, I said, oh, hey, can we drop my friend Chris off at his house on the way?
Well, sure.
And the joke became that he might slow down for Chris to get out of the car. Pulling into the driveway, back out of the driveway, was gas burning for no reason. He kind of went to the nearest corner, wasn't going to turn in, and get out, money's burning. You know what I mean? Yeah. So that, I guess I've taken that into my adult life with me. Now that both my parents are dead and gone, they left with me that healthy fear of just preparing for the future. Acting is the most stupid profession to get into if you want something safe and solid, right? Because it's every job I get is going to come to an end. And will I ever get another one? I don't know. I've had many times, many years along the way in the last 20 years where there's been a lull. My Flory and I, we do adhere to my parents' wishes of spending less than we make. So we live in a very modest house, drive very modest cars. Everything's paid off. I have had real estate loans, but our first condo we bought, I got a really good movie job and wanted to pay it off in one lump. I got advice from all kinds of people. Do not pay your house off. If you have extra money, then invest in, you know, the stock market or something. And I felt like, no, with my up and down career, I would rather have the peace of mind knowing that they can't take my house away. So we paid that condo off, and it's the smartest thing I've ever done because, you know, the stock market has been all over the place since I got that advice. And I've never had to ask a friend or family member for more money for a loan. People tend to spend based on what they think they're going to be making in the next year or the next month or, you know, oh, I can pay that off later. And I've done the opposite. Wealth is not measured by how much money you earn, but by how much you can actually hang on to.
Find out more about Doug Jones and his family finance lessons at MarketplaceMoney.org. This is Marketplace Money from APM. A few days ago, a campaign debuted featuring women like Beyoncé, Condoleezza Rice, and actress Jane Lynch to eliminate a certain B word from our vocabulary.
Bossy.
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 The video to ban Bossy has gotten more than 1.5 million views, and it's sparking a debate about language, leadership, and gender bias in the workplace. A recent Gallup poll shows 66% of Americans say they prefer working for a male boss, and women still make up less than 15% of CEOs in the U.S. So how much do words like bossy matter? We asked Victoria Breskel to consider that. She is an assistant professor of organizational behavior at the Yale School of Management. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'd like to get your reaction to this campaign to ban bossy, kind of spearheaded by Sheryl Sandberg and personified most popularly by Beyoncé.
I think it's a fantastic idea. It's one of those things where the word bossy for women and girls really connotates that women and girls should not take on leadership roles. And bossy, to me, means that girls and women are sort of overstepping their bounds or being obnoxious in some ways. And I don't think that Sandberg or any of the celebrities that have endorsed this campaign mean that the word bossy should be censored, but really it's just to sort of raise awareness about the power of language at school and in the workplace that really can end up holding women and girls back in certain ways.
Well, I'm going to push you on that. You know, I'm the host of the show. I make decisions about what's the final product that goes on the air. I'm bossy about it. What's wrong with being bossy?
I actually don't think there's anything wrong with it at all. I think that essentially what that means is that you're being assertive, that you're stating what you want. And it's certainly within your role and your job to make that happen. And so the word bossy, I think, is just it has a negative connotation. It's not a good thing. I think that when girls and women are called bossy, they think that they should probably stop stepping up and telling other people what to do. But leaders have to step up and tell people what to do. That's their job.
Are there other words that you think land in the same way? I remember early in my career fighting for a story and being called emotional in the process.
Oh, yeah. You know, I think you actually hit on a huge one. I think emotional is another word that really people just view women as much more emotional than men. But, you know, men do display emotion. We know that men are more likely to display anger, for example. But oftentimes we don't really see men getting angry at work, particularly in leadership roles, as being sort of overly emotional. We sort of only see women that way. Emotional and bossy, those two things, I think, are probably the two primary things that hold women back at work.
How important is language? Because we're talking about words, but really the things that change organizations are behaviors, hiring,
sure,
promotion, mentorship. Are we focusing on the wrong things when we talk about language?
I don't think we're focusing on the wrong things necessarily. I think it's one piece of the puzzle, right? It's one aspect of what might be holding women back from advancing into leadership roles. If we are consistently using language that negatively labels one gender but not the other for exactly the same behavior, in this case being assertive or telling people what to do, then eventually that's going to probably translate into people seeing that individual, in this case a woman, in a negative light. And then, in fact, what my research and a lot of my other colleagues that do work in this area shows is that when we describe people with those labels, or they're described in that way, then we are less likely to promote them, to hire them, to even pay them less sometimes.
How do you be your own best advocate, even bossy, if you will, to make sure you're being paid right?
There's a lot of research on this issue of self-promotion, and it is difficult for women to actually talk about why they should be paid more, why they're particularly qualified for a job or a raise or a promotion. But the fact of the matter is that even though people don't necessarily respond well to women in those situations when they actually do that, without doing it, it's never going to happen. There's a lot to be learned from how women initiate negotiations, for one thing, and generally behave assertively. And that has to do with really just starting out and asking for that raise or talking about why you're qualified for a promotion. Once women start doing that, I think in larger numbers, and it becomes a lot more common, over time, the stereotypes are going to change. But, you know, right now, it's certainly not an easy thing to do. I recognize that. But it is, I think, the first thing that needs to happen.
Victoria Breskel from the Yale School of Management, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're so welcome. Thank you.
We heard from plenty of people this week who aren't on board with the campaign to ban bossy. And we asked one woman to talk with us about her very special relationship with the word that Sheryl Sandberg wants to toss out.
My name is Georgia Getz. I'm from Philadelphia. And for the past 8 years, I've had a blog named I Am Bossy. Bossy is a humor pop culture blog, which I write in the third person as my alter ego named Bossy. But my identification with that word goes back decades before the blog began. I think that the word bossy is a point of pride for many women. The description bossy links generations of go-getters who are comfortable in their skin and powerhouses in their profession. And I chose bossy as an alter ego name for my blog because so many people do identify themselves in a positive light with that word. I always thought that bossy was something associated with, you know, really knowing who you are and asserting yourself, sort of a humorous description for someone who felt that their voice should be heard and their opinions met. I'm not sure that it is a word that's just used for girls. I have a friend who told her 10-year-old daughter about the word, and she said that she and her friends use bossy to describe both boys and girls. And I'm really sort of not sure that when a little girl is assertive, she's called bossy, but when a little boy is assertive, he's called leader, because sometimes that boy is called bully. Sheryl Sandberg has a powerful platform, but this campaign seems like a deep dive into a shallow pool. In the pantheon of offensive, there are worse words used to describe women, but they shouldn't be banned either. I take great interest in the many women who are standing with Sheryl Sandberg in their collective admonishment of having been called bossy as girls, because who are these women today? As the campaign notes, they're world leaders and Supreme Court justices and presidential candidates, CEOs, publishers, rock stars. And so if bossy is the adjective these powerhouses have in common, a confidence and personality, you know, that propelled them to accomplish these great things, then maybe the more liberated movement isn't killing a word, but owning the grit in its meaning.
Georgia Getz is the author of the blog IamBossy.com and tweets, you guessed it, at Bossy. We asked you guys for your reactions to the Ban Bossy campaign and got quite a few responses. Here's a sampling. Jennifer Kopp wrote us on Facebook that leadership and bossy are not the same thing. Brad Hecht wrote, my wife has called me bossy when she feels I'm telling folks what to do versus asking them with all the implied courtesy. And Jason Kunkel asked,
isn't it bossy to ban the word bossy? So what do you think? Is the word bossy loaded? And does banning it matter? Write to us on our webpage at marketplacemoney.org or tweet us at LiveMoney. And that's it. That's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, what happens when neighborhoods struggle with culture and class? A look at gentrification in some of America's rapidly changing neighborhoods. Marketplace Money is produced by Candace Manriquez, Raghu Manavalan, and Lindsay Foster Thomas. Our senior producer is Dan Semitovich. Jeff Peters is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. And I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Remember, always check with your financial professional before you make any big money decisions. And thanks for listening.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.